The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, this is Brett King. Welcome back to Breaking Banks live from New York. We have, as Donald Trump would say, a huge show for you today. We have this special episode of Breaking Banks. We join Radio Everyone and the United Nations to talk about the 17 global goals to end extreme poverty, fight inequality and injustice, and fix climate change. If you want some more information on that, check out globalgoals.org as we talk about that. We also have coming up Jen Tesher, CEO and President of the Center for Financial Services Innovation, and Scott McCormick, the CEO and President of Social Money, and be great to have those guys back on the show. But before we get to that, the goals that we're talking about as part of this UN Global Goals Week, in reality, all of these goals obviously need some focus, but you can't end poverty or hunger without looking at things like fixing climate change and getting to a banking system that works to provide people with access to credit and access to payments and be able to run their business and things like that. We need to have solutions like this. We need to focus on the innovation and the fintech industry, the financial services industry. We have a big part of this to play because we've got to get this financial inclusion going, and technology is really a key part of that. You know, we talk about that a lot on the show. Now, we're going to have later in the show, we're going to talk to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But in Bill and Melinda Gates' annual letter, they argued that technology can be used to dramatically improve the lives of the poor, and that their lives will improve more than anyone's with access to financial services. Now, we're extremely fortunate. This is a great moment for the show here. We're really fortunate to hear from Bill Gates himself on the show through our affiliate network, Radio Everyone. He's going to talk to us about how technology can help solve these problems. So here's Bill Gates.
Well, the amazing thing about the world is we have more and more wealth, more and more technology every year, and yet the inequity, the fact that 2 billion people still live in poverty, means we're not applying those resources the way we should. And yet we have digital platforms like Facebook. So the fact that the poorest are far away and you don't really see the kids who are suffering from malaria, you don't see the women who don't get a chance to get an education, or the farmers whose productivity is so low they can't nourish their kids. And by joining together, having a movement and saying these incredible goals that the world's adopting for the next 15 years, let's be serious about them, let's track them, let's get involved. We think that this can really drive the leaders, drive the resources, and get the world to be far more equitable.
Thank you, Bill Gates. So, Jen Tesher, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brett. So glad to be here.
So what do you think of what Bill Gates said about how we solve these problems?
I am in complete agreement. It's essentially why I founded CFSI over 10 years ago, with the recognition that technology was dramatically changing the world we lived in and changing the opportunity in the financial services industry to better reach and serve folks who are inequitably served and who are struggling and more than others might actually need the products and the help that financial services companies can provide. So if I had known then what I know now, I'm not sure what I would have done, because, 11 years ago, Mark Zuckerberg had just founded Facebook in his dorm room. And we didn't have the iPhone yet. And we couldn't have even dreamed about some of the things that would come to pass. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time to be doing this work.
Because before really we had a technology approach to this problem, it was all about, you know, financial inclusion was all about education and literacy. But we're now learning that, you know, access is a key hurdle for people, isn't it?
It is. Although, in a funny way, we're in the moment of realizing that access alone is insufficient as well. So we've gone from thinking education alone would do it to then realizing, well, it's important for people to have the tools to make good choices and behaviors, but that assumes they have choices in the first place, right? So then we spend a lot of time on access, both here in the U.S., but particularly in the financial inclusion movement globally. And now we're all coming to terms with the idea that access alone and knowing how to do it alone is insufficient. There's more we need to be doing to enable people to actually have tools that help them manage their money, that help them make decisions, that help them optimize for the volatility in their lives, the day-to-day challenges that they face. Technology really has the power to make it much simpler and easier for people to make good decisions and really take the stress out of their lives that then has so many other implications around their own physical health, their own productivity on the job, and those sorts of things.
So this is really, you know, for the Center for Financial Services Innovation, as you go about this, you guys do quite a bit of research on this, don't you? So what's been sort of the most surprising thing you've learned through research on the mechanics around financial inclusion and what people really need to be included in the financial system?
Yeah, so we did a real landmark study last year. You know, we're really focused on promoting financial health. And financial health, we believe, comes about when your day-to-day system enables you to build resilience and pursue opportunities. And so we wanted to get a better picture of the state of financial health in America. So last year we did a major national study. And I think the thing that was most surprising about the study was that more than half of Americans are struggling financially, 57% to be exact. And even more surprising than that is that one-third of those who make more than $100,000 a year are in that category, are struggling financially. So this isn't just a niche problem. It's not just a problem for poor people. It matters a lot to them. But this notion of financial instability or financial ill health is quite widespread and has significant implications, not just for individuals and for families, but for communities and for the broader macro economy. So we think it's really important for, as you said, financial services providers, but also a whole range of other industries and verticals to understand that if we can't do more to help Americans and, frankly, global citizens get on stronger financial footing, it's really going to hold us all back.
Mm. So how does CFSI work? What are the connections that you guys pull together to make these changes?
So as much as we think that there's some important work to do on the demand side, like really understanding how consumers want to be communicated with and helping them understand what the opportunities are out there, we think the real opportunity and the real challenge is on the supply side, getting a system that offers the kinds of products and policies and experiences that are going to appeal to consumers, that are going to actually help solve a real pain point in their lives, and are going to help them get ahead. And in order to do that, we think it's all about the mashup, if you will. There are so many interesting players in the space, new and old, and we take the view that we don't think it's a winner-take-all approach. We think that it's going to be the connections, both formal and formal, amongst the various players in the industry that are going to be what results in the best outcome for consumers. So, because consumers care much less about the form and much more about the function, right? Just get me something that solves my problem in a way that's easy and delightful, and I don't really care who's offering it to me. And so, you know, we're trying to do the work behind the scenes, if you will, to help bring together various parties, whether it's banks or fintech companies or nonprofit organizations, to both deeply understand the needs of financially struggling consumers and then to design and execute with them in mind.
Absolutely. So one of those organizations that you work with is actually our next guest. It's Scott McCormack, and this is Scott is the CEO and president of Social Money, and also involved in Smarty Pig, one of the U.S. Implementations of that. Scott, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brett. I appreciate being here.
So before we get into Social Money and the work you're doing in India, how do you work with the CFSI?
Well, you know, I think we mold a lot of what we do in our company around a lot of the, you know, a lot of the things that Jen was talking about. So, you know, when you go to the origins of Smarty Pig and how we built our organization, you know, we built a product that really met the needs of many customers who wanted to save for things that they wanted or needed. But we made not only the experience really well, you know, fantastic, but we also brought the cost paradigm into conjunction with that to the extent that the client satisfaction in that product, people share, you know, 75% of their goals on that product. There's just been a lot of complete great learnings that we've applied from that product into what we're doing, you know, right now with our India project and how we're approaching what we do over there.
Okay, so tell us about that project. Tell us about what's happening in India, who you're working with, you know, what's your experiences there, and you know, I mean, if you're going to have a test market, India would be a great market to look at eradicating extreme poverty as part of the global goals. So how do you do that?
So interestingly enough, what we did, you know, we're a grantee now of the Gates Foundation as of January of this year. What's interesting about what we're doing there is we're really not doing any true front-end work with the end customer. I did participate and do a project with the foundation a year ago where we did a lot of discovery and research inside the slum areas in several different states and areas in India where we actually saw firsthand the challenges that customers were presented with financial services, you know, the challenges around trust, the challenges around time and convenience. You know, just a lot of the evidence that you see right away when you land in India, you know, we saw it firsthand. What we're doing over there is we pulled a piece of our technology out of Smarty Pig. We own and operate and built our own system of record, deposit system of record, that stands up for banks here in the States. We call that product CorePro. And what we're doing is we're actually allowing CorePro to stand up so that technology services providers who actually reach the end mile customer can actually build feature phone mobile user experiences around goal-based savings into those applications. And so what we've done is we've taken a key component that allowed us to do business here in the States, you know, that back-end underbelly that we built to stand up for bank partners like West Bank and BBVA. We actually are reapplying that in a different way overseas and allowing those technology services providers to actually code on top of it. And in doing so, we're flattening the cost structure so that they can do that. Because one of the big challenges over there when you actually reach a customer is that they're really not, you know, heavy value, meaning deposit value type of customers. So they're difficult for banks or others to really pay attention to, primarily because the value of that customer, you know, has some challenges to the P&L. So what we've done with CorePro is drop that cost down so it becomes equitable.
Okay, so Jen, let me come back to you within the CFSI. This is a very real problem in developed economies like the United States as well, that the cost of banks supporting financial inclusion for lower to middle income is now, because the cost of delivery of those services is so high, they're very unattractive segments. So what's happening to those people? Because we're starting to see less people get access to the financial services system.
You know, in a funny way, on the transaction side of the house, I feel like access is at an all-time high because of the ubiquity now of prepaid cards. And in fact, most of the innovation we see happening in the fintech arena is really building off of a prepaid card kind of infrastructure, if you will. And I think that CorePro is just a great example of a company really going the next step to create a deposit of record system. I think that's exactly the right thing, and it's exactly what we're starting to see, is that entrepreneurs like SmartyPig are creating platforms that banks that have higher fixed costs can then use as a way to still reach the consumer, but at a lower price point. We're seeing it in transactions. We're seeing it in lending. It's one of the phenomenons that we're seeing through marketplace lending. And it's sort of what I was talking about earlier about the power of the mashup. You know, if a bank has great reach and can reach these customers and offer a savings solution as an example, but can't afford to do so because it's too expensive, but SmartyPig can drop the cost, by being a back-end service provider, you know, then everybody wins.
Yeah, yeah. So, Scott, you know, how does the work you do in India differ from what you do here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, what we did is we had, with SmartyPig, when we built SmartyPig, we had both banks.
That is direct-to-consumer, right? But you have a partnership with BBVA.
Yeah, and so we had banks and alternative financial services companies come to our company and ask, you know, how did you do this? You know, what was, you know, what's the secret? And what we found is that system of record, that deposit system of record, was really more valuable to, you know, raising all ships. And so we decided to enterprise that back end system of record, so it wasn't just proprietary for us and our bank. We actually decided to enterprise it, commercialize it, and then offer it. So CorePro is accessible to both banks and non-banks in the United States to use. A lot of what we do and in the conversations and the clients that are either using it now or about to use it, they're all focused on digital and mobile banking. So building those applications and those user experiences like Jen talked about earlier, I mean, if you can reach the customer with something valuable that creates loyalty and creates things around experience, and you can do that on a flattened infrastructure where that cost paradigm is low enough, then everything doesn't have to be built around a prepaid business model, right? You can actually do things right for your customer that don't have to rely on the economics that are sometimes challenging when you have multiple parties engaged in that mashup, per se, that Jen talked about.
Exactly.
So listen, guys, the 17 global goals, ending extreme poverty, fighting inequality, injustice, climate change, financial inclusion, 2030, what is going to be the, you know, in terms of fintech and financial services, what's the best thing we can do to solve these problems? You got about a minute.
Wow.
Scott, you go first.
Well, I would tell you one thing that I tell people, and I'm presenting tomorrow at a conference, I would tell you one thing to pay attention to is what India just did with the deposit and payment bank licenses. So you have non-banks that were just granted licenses that are going to get in and actually participate. They have scale. They have reach. They have all the things that actually allow for financial inclusion to be looked at differently by all the parties that play.
I don't know the right answer to that question
because I don't have, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. But I would say pay attention to that, because if that happened here, then that would create a lot of unique circumstances that would change the dynamic of what happens here. So I think we should just all prepare for, you know, trying to get those costs down.
Okay, so we're running out of time, I'm afraid, Scott. Hey, Scott, thanks for coming in. Where can we check out SmartyPig, Social Money?
Yeah, go to corepro.io. or socialmoney.com, and you can find everything about what we're doing, and appreciate again, thanks for having us.
And Jen, where can we find out about the CFSI?
So to join our network and participate, you can go to www.cfsinnovation.com, and everything you need will be right there.
Absolutely fantastic. Thanks, guys, for joining us on this very special Global Goals version of Breaking Banks today. Up now, we're going to have Bill Gates again and hear what some other people said about what the world's going to look like in the year 2030 as we fight these, get towards these global goals. Over to you, Bill.
It's an idea that all of humanity matters, that yes, yourself, your family, your country, those are things that you're very loyal to and you care about. You should get engaged in those things. But broadly, there's 7 billion people. The ones who are in the toughest shape, the poorest 2 billion, most of those are in places that we don't get to very often. And so our awareness of that, our sense of possibility, the sense of change, we really need a critical mass of people to come together around this.
In 2030,
I would like to see a global economy that is balanced, where there are no longer any underdeveloped countries. This would stop the brain drain. African intellectuals would no longer need to emigrate to Europe or the US in order to profit from a good education.
The kind of world that I would like to see in 2030 is a kind of world that does not have poverty or hunger at all. A kind of world whereby everybody will have enough food and be able to be sustained. A kind of world whereby children will be born and they will live for some years until they die at a later stage, unlike these days whereby a lot of children are dying at birth. A kind of world where there will be gender equality, rather than this world where women are looked down upon as people who cannot do the same things that men do.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
As you guys know, I talk a lot about the fact that financial inclusion is going to change dramatically over the next 5 to 10 years as a result of the introduction of the smartphone. You know, we have already seen the fastest ever shift in financial inclusion as a result of the introduction of mobile money services like M-Pesa, Bcash in Bangladesh, Globe, Gcash, and others around the world. And even if you look at mobile money services services in China, the Mobile Money Market Fund, Weibo by Alipay, you know, which garnered $90 billion in deposits in just an 8-month period, we are starting to see the fastest ever financial inclusion ever in the history of banking. And it's not because of bank branches. It's not because of traditional bank products and services. There's an opportunity. But there still remains 2 to 2.5 billion people who are unbanked in the world. So we're going to talk to two people who are really on the cusp of this revolution in financial inclusion today. And that is Costa Peric, the Deputy Director, Level 1 Digital Payment Systems, Financial Services for the Poor, at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and also the Senior Program Officer from the same program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, David Lubinsky. David and Costa, welcome to Breaking Banks. Or Costa, welcome back.
Hey, Brett.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, yeah. So first of all, let me just ask you guys, you know, those titles seem very long-winded, but, you know, Costa, you've, of course, a technologist. You wrote a book called The Castle in the Sandbox, and you've been involved with InnerTribe and Swift previously. Just for those that aren't familiar with you, tell us about your role at Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yeah, so David and I, we work in this particular strategy of the Gates Foundation focused on digital financial inclusion. It's, as you said, our vision, our passion is to connect the 2 billion people that are unbanked today and that are very poor to a safe, reliable financial system based on mobile money, as you very rightly mentioned. We are working in South Asia and Africa to do so. So all innovations in business model and technology are leveraged to do so in order to get these super fast, efficient, and affordable financial systems.
Very good. And David, tell us a little bit about your background. You don't come from a banking background. You come from health, finance, and public policy, right?
That is correct. And the journey that I took to get onto Costa's team and to do this work at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation really came through looking at development broadly, health in development in particular. And what we learned early on is applying systems-level thinking for how can health systems perform better, what are the factors of performance, and is there the possibility for improvement in performance to come from applying, you know, some of these basic skills and approaches from industry. And what we found is that there was a convergence, a critical convergence, particularly within the Gates Foundation, where work that was happening in health, for example, how do we get children immunized, continually bumped up against issues of financial services. For example, how can a mother get a small subsidy to pay for taxi fare to bring a child to an immunization clinic? How could a farmer get a small amount of credit to be able to purchase the proper seeds to increase their yield? And so what we found at the foundation is that there was this crossover between health, agriculture, and nutrition, and these basic financial services. So that's really what raised the opportunity for me to join the team and join Costa to say, how can we apply this kind of systems level thinking to the convergence of financial services and serving the very poor?
So if you want to lift people out of poverty, it's not just giving them money. You actually have to give them access to the financial system, because that enables them to buy and sell. It enables them to get credit, et cetera, right?
This is exactly right. And what we find, early data shows that when people have access to the system, they have access to these basic financial services, receive money, transfer money, be able to accept credit, and then apply those funds for other purposes, is that household welfare improves. Farmers get greater yields. Families have greater income, and there's more saving.
Good. Now, we've heard Bill Gates, of course, talk about getting people out of poverty, and Bill was the keynote speaker or the closing plenary at SIBOS last year, where he gave an excellent coverage of this, and he's been in the press. But let me ask you two gentlemen, what's happening on the ground? How does Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation roll out programs on the ground that make material changes?
Yeah, let me start, and then David will talk about some country experiences. So since indeed last year, Brett, where essentially what Bill Gates told to SIBOS is that financial inclusion is not about charity, that the banks should provide charity for people to get connected. It is truly about a new opportunity, a new business model brought by the huge scale of transactions that could be brought if we connect indeed the 2 billion people that remain unconnected today. So since then, we have refined our thinking, and we have published that thinking about how, what does it look like and how this can be done. On a public website, we call our endeavor, we call it Level One Project, and you can read all about it on the website levelOneProject.org, all in one word. And there, essentially, we have gone to a great detail about what is this vision of a digital financial system, and how does it work in a way that poor people can be reached, but in a profitable way for the providers. So that's one. And then the second is we have focused our work to deploy, to help deploy a level one project compliance system in country, in countries where we work. So David, please tell us as well on what we are doing, for example, in Nigeria and Pakistan.
Thank you. This is really where it gets quite exciting because as a foundation, you know, we're able to apply our energies and our resources to look at the problem in a unique way that might not make sense for the commercial sector, or where the commercial sector maybe needs a little bit of a catalyst, or whether we need to invest in a way that reduces the risk of commercial sector players. And our focus in the next 12 to 24 months is just as Costa said. We're going to focus on Nigeria and Pakistan and look at how, in fact, the connectivity, as you described earlier, Brett, how people can get connected to the payment system. What are those first level basic use cases of getting money, transferring money, perhaps accessing credit, saving, and the ability to make payments, whether that's for school fees, health services, agricultural products. And we're going to focus on the ground, working very closely with the stakeholders, including the commercial sector. And you asked a specific question of how this actually looks on the ground. And I think your audience, and in fact, looks at different ways that financial technology is actually transforming the industry. And as you recall, when Bill spoke at Cybos, you know, the dynamic of many technologies that benefit the poor are trickle-down technologies, meaning they come from the rich world and they find their way being adapted or applied. We believe that there's equal potential for trickle-up, meaning working deeply in Nigeria and Pakistan and perhaps other countries, we're going to find ways to give people access, deliver these services in ways that might be very different than the way the developed world accomplishes these things today. And so we take a very open mind to our work in these countries. We're open to work with many partners, commercial sector, social ventures, non-government, to find the right way to accomplish that connectivity, get people financial services that they really find useful.
It's interesting. We had Dave Birch on the show not that long ago. He was talking about a project in Nigeria, TAP.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're involved in that, but using mesh networking to get around the issues of poor cellular service. How dependent are we on technology infrastructure like cellular data networks and so forth for this stuff to be successful?
Yeah, let me give a first stab at that. So the whole endeavor is very, very relying on technology, because in fact, you know, the whole problem is to reach these 2 billion people who, they are not in big cities, they are outside, you know, the reach of any ATM or any bank branch. So truly, the technology and in the first technology that we leverage is, of course, the mobile phone and the capacity of even the simplest mobile phones to be the adequate instrument for mobile money transactions. You know, literally, you send money in the same way that you send a text message, even from the simplest phone. We know that works, and that's certainly okay. The other enablers, technology enablers, that we have to do with identity. So the digital identity domain is very, very important. And there is a number of technologies that have to do with biometrics, for example, like the Indians, they are doing in India with Aadhaar, are very, very important as well. Then there is the whole domain of merchant transactions. We have run, I was telling you, Brett, one of the last times I came over, that we also are launching challenges to see how technology can help simplify merchant transactions to the extent that they be as fail-proof and easy to use as possible. And we got some great ideas there. And then there is the whole notion of how the whole system, including settlement, can be made much more efficient and capable of processing, you know, if we are successful, the systems we are talking about will process 10, 20,000, 30,000 transactions per second, given all the connectivity. So technology is a huge enabler.
It's very interesting, actually. If you look at M-Pesa in Kenya, where it was extraordinarily successful, what's, you know, three-fourths of the population now using that service, and Bcash in Bangladesh has been really successful. But, you know, we haven't had that breakout success necessarily in other markets. So the infrastructure that they've got in place, if they've got a lot of legacy systems versus greenfield, what makes a great market for you guys to go into? What's the perfect combination of regulation, incumbents, cellular technology, mobile adoption? You know, what makes the perfect market for a test case like this?
Yeah. So, David, you want to go first on this one?
I'd be happy to. Yeah. I think that's a fantastic question. You know, there's a couple of dynamics that I think are really important. And again, your listeners are probably eager to look at where the innovations are taking place at the edge that are either reforming or transforming or maybe even disrupting financial services globally. And one of the important kind of foundational approaches is we work with the commercial sector and everyone you mentioned, Brett, but we also need to work in a way that has clarity on what are the economics involved and who are the players that are able to deliver the kind of richness, the robustness of the kind of infrastructure that Costa was referring to that can handle those large transaction loads, as well as who are the innovators that can then ride on that platform or ride on those rails. And so we spend a lot of time in markets with the very players that you mentioned, but we also have the conversation about the economics of cost to serve their customers. And so many traditional banks who we work with, many of whom we've collaborated closely with, we have the conversations and learn much more about how do you reduce the cost to serve when in fact the customer may have only $2 or $3 or $4 of income per day versus their wealthier customers that fit very nicely in a very traditional business model approach. So I would say rather than the market condition, although that's important and we spend a good deal of time with regulators and policymakers to make sure that roadblocks for good market development are removed or countered, it's equally important that we spend the time with the players. And as I mentioned earlier, and you mentioned at the top of the show, players like Alipay that can generate $90 billion deposits in such short order. Who would have guessed that?
No, we couldn't see it coming. In fact, you know, I always use that stat. I say there's no bank network in the world that has ever raised $90 billion in deposits in 8 months. So as a proof point for mobile, it's just so huge.
And that's the kind of potential we believe. As Costa referred to, the transaction volumes could be enormous. And even though people that are extremely poor tend to transact in small amounts, they transact in high volume.
So let me just ask you guys, how much time do you spend on the road tactically working with all these different people? It sounds very complex. So how often are you on the road? How often are you traveling? You know, what's that schedule like?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. But I can tell you, David and I and our team, we spend a lot of time in on the ground in the countries, you know, Nigeria and Pakistan, because at the end of the day, first we need to establish our intermediaries there, because there's got to be somebody there representing us 24/7. So we spend a lot of time cultivating our intermediaries on the ground. But we also spend a lot of time, as David mentioned, our strategy is all hands need to be on deck. So we talk with the government, we talk with the central banks, we talk with the banks, we talk with the mobile network operators, we talk with the technology providers, we talk with the fintech startup community. Because at the end of the day, all of this is a joint collaborative effort to a certain extent to set the rails right and generate innovation. So this notion of shared rails is central to the level one project idea. Having these super efficient payment platforms do require some collaboration. And you ask an interesting question about, what makes it, from acceptable from the regulator's perspective. So we go on the basis that, the regulator needs to accept, needs to recognize, to endorse the system, and so therefore that the right amount of controls from the perspective of anti-money laundering, anti-terrorism financing, compliance be also in the system, so that it is a fully operational system. It's not some gadget system on the side.
They've got to be focused on this end game, which is got to get that financial inclusion. And if you're there trying to protect incumbents or whatever the case may be, skew it. So let me just ask you one final question. How often are you guys meeting with Bill and Melinda, one-on-one to keep them involved in this process?
We do. So as you perhaps have caught, Brett, so early this year, in the annual letter that Bill and Melinda Gates publish every year, they made our work one of their big bets among four others. Digital financial inclusion is one of their five bets for a better world at the horizon of 2030. So they are quite close to this, and we do we do maintain a very firm relationship with both, because they are at the same time, of course, they need to be comfortable with a level one project, but they are also a great advocate when they themselves go, which they do a lot, to the countries where we work in. They are a great voice also for us to promote and to make sure that the government and the country stakeholders are focused on the ultimate objective.
Fantastic. All right, so you guys have got the Level One Project. It's level1project.org if you want to check out some more information about it. David Lubinsky and Costa Perry, thanks for being on Breaking Banks today.
It was a pleasure, Brett.
Thank you very much, Brett.
You're welcome. Okay, guys, listen, we're going to have a quick break.
My name is Chris Hadfield. I've been an astronaut for 21 years, lucky enough to fly in space 3 times, and have the privilege of commanding the International Space Station. Most of us grow up with a real strong familiarity of some small part of the Earth. When you see the whole planet 16 times a day, you see all 7 billion people every single day. After a while, it just starts seeping into you that the us and them is just imaginary, and the whole thing is just us. We're all in this together.
In 2030, I hope the world is a smarter, happier, and more peaceful place. Poverty and disadvantage might not have been entirely wiped out, but they're being measured and talked about, and things are changing. It is just as normal now to see a report in the media on the gross national well-being and happiness quotient as it is to see a report on the gross domestic product. More and more technology is being developed to improve the quality of human life and to protect and preserve our planet. And once developed, these new technologies are being quickly utilized. And we still have coral reefs and bees.
I want to live in a world where people don't have to risk their lives crossing oceans to find safety from war and persecution. In 2030, I really hope that we can find a way to overcome the fear of foreigners instead of being afraid. I would really hope that we see each other as fellow humans.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866-866 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We are on our United Nations Global Goals special edition show with Radio Everyone. And before the break, we obviously had the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on with Costa and the team there talking about some of the stuff going on there. Right now, we'd like to welcome back to the show Sam Moore, one of our longtime FinTech Mafia associates. Sam, welcome back.
Hi, Brett. Thanks.
So thanks for being in the studio with us today.
I'm actually in the Moven office. It's fantastic.
Yeah, well, it doubles as a studio, as you know. So, and we have with you, Sam, Alan Grundy. Alan, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I understand you are the Economic Recovery and Development Director for Rescue.org.
No. Quick clarification there. A coordinator. The director is my boss's boss.
Coordinator.
Yes. I'm a lowly,
Well, yeah, but coordinator director, it doesn't sound that different. Okay, yeah, director directs, a coordinator coordinates. Yeah.
Exactly.
And, you know, I always, you would not know what I mean when you say you're part of Rescue.org or the International Rescue Committee. Would you understand if I made a thunder Bird reference?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to listen to your previous podcast with Barry, and I heard the Thunderbird.
Okay, well, you should watch the old Thunderbird series, and you get it, International Rescue, but it's fine. So we're not talking about spaceships and aircraft today, but we are talking about the refugee crisis and some of the what the Digital Finance Institute and Rescue.org have been working on. Sam, first of all, give us a bit of an update on the status of DFI's Refugee Bank and what the plans are for next year.
Sure. It's really been a busy couple months, in all honesty. Actually, as we speak, Christine Duhaim, who's the founder of the Digital Finance Institute.
She was on the show a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago.
She's actually in Iran right now, even as we speak. I've been getting emails back and forth from her. It's quite the experience. We're in the process of whitening.
Have you been to Iran?
I'm going to miss a trip to Kish Island. We're actually doing a DFI event in Kish Island, and I can't go. I'm so disappointed. I believe it's October 7th and 8th.
Well, we have some listeners from Iran on Breaking Banks, but I've been to Iran twice, in 2008 and then last year at the invitation of the central bank governor. And Tehran particularly is a beautiful city. The people are lovely. I found it a bit of a shock, of course, because trained by the Western media to have my expectations of Iran were as I'd been trained, and found it completely the opposite. I know Chris Skinner spent a fair bit of time in Iran too, but it's actually a really nice country.
Yeah, Fasil Khan, in front of ours,
yep,
said he finds the Iranians to be the most friendly people that he interacts with.
I think that's a fair comment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've found them always to be really friendly. So anyway, sorry. So Christine's up there in Iran?
Christine's up there right now working on some of this. As a matter of fact, she's working on a pilot program with some of the banks there around doing payments to address the refugee crisis in Iran. There's actually over, and Alan can correct me here, but my understanding is over 1 million refugees just in that area right there. So they have a significant reason to want to be part of this program. We're also neck deep in finishing up a white paper on the refugee crisis from a financial inclusion standpoint, from a fintech standpoint, that we will release during Sibos. And we're getting ready to fly over to Singapore for Sibos. We'll be doing a session, I believe it's on Tuesday the 13th, if I remember right, at Sibos with Costa Peric, who you had mentioned before.
Yeah.
Christine and I will be there along with Daniel Morozitz, who's the president of Earthport.
Yeah, I know Daniel.
And Ashtar Bajkowicz, who's from Chief Catalyst in the Innovations Group. So we'll be speaking about this specific topic, financial inclusion for refugees and how we can work to solve that. And to be honest, it all started with Alan in Istanbul about a year ago.
Great. So you're based now in Washington, Alan, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So, we hear a lot of news about the flood of refugees into Europe right now, but do you want to give the listeners who are sort of, maybe they didn't hear Christine last time on the show, some of the difficulties that, you know, Syrian refugees and others that are flooding into Europe right now will have just purely because of the fact that they don't have access to a functioning banking system?
The refugee situation and the migrant situation in Europe is complicated, to say the least. And presently, the International Risk Committee, or IRC. It has an operation based out of Lesbos in Greece, who's working, basically receiving about 2,000 to 3,000 refugees a day, and processing them, or helping them transport them to the processing center and supporting them with protection and water and sanitation activities. But the situation that we're seeing is that there's the level of need for these people. I mean, they're coming from a very difficult situation based out of Syria, who potentially were in Turkey prior to the crossing over into Greece. Sure. And they're making their migration north. But their access to funds is really whatever they're carrying with them. So what we're looking at is how can we support them during that migration?
And some of these people, of course, may have left bank accounts and businesses and things like that, but they of course, can't get access to any funds they might have in the bank back in Syria, for example, right?
Yeah, correct. I mean, these are probably the most vulnerable. I mean, if you're leaving, it's really because you don't have anywhere else to go. So they don't really have access to that many resources. So they're carrying whatever they have. And if they don't have anything, if they spent it all on just paying for the crossover, the waterway from Turkey into Greece, that's really usually their biggest cost. The question is, how are they going to cover their needs until they reach their destination? And then you come into all these issues. I mean, and these are similar issues that arise from other refugee crises that we've seen in the past. You know, how do people cover these needs? And you go into protection concerns, or all these risks started accumulating for this population.
So how do you help them when you meet with them on the ground, apart from getting them registered and so forth? What tactical things can you help them with in terms of day-to-day needs?
So the IRC is working. One of the main lines, and specifically what I work in, is the distribution of financial assistance or cash transfer programming. We provide assistance to cover their basic needs, immediate basic needs, in order to improve their survival through their whatever crisis they're living. That process to identify those needs is difficult, and it's really based on the context. The reality is that presently in Greece, the situation it's complicated regarding the specific needs that they have, because you have a very diverse, let's say, population. First of all, from different contexts, Syria being the main population, but also you have from Iraq, from Afghanistan, Ethiopia, and so it's pretty different scenario needs. The reality is that upon arriving, what's called arriving to I'm leaving to Greece next week. So yep. Arriving to Greece, one of the jobs that I have to do is actually assessing those needs and see how much actually we can cover within the budget limitations that we have. Because okay. The IRC as an organization is limited in how much money we can actually spend, because we don't have access to that much funding.
Where do you guys currently get your funding?
We get public donations and then grants from government or other foundations.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. So how do you think ideas that we're working on in the fintech space, I mean, mostly the listeners for this radio show, although, you know, we go out on terrestrial in New York and elsewhere across the US, but the vast majority of our listeners are interested in technology. So mm-hmm. What sort of technology, like the blockchain and, you know, right. mobile money services and things like that, do you see potential for helping these situations?
A lot. I was lucky enough to participate in the recent conference in New York, Consensus 2015, where I was invited to speak as part of a panel. And I had the great opportunity to participate or to be in the panel with Bill Barnhart and Wally. I'm not going to go into his name because it's difficult for me to pronounce, but he works for Orange. And Bill is the founder of Abra. Abra is a company all right, everybody knows Abra, great. They did a big announcement right before as well, so they were making a big splash. And during this discussion, I was expressing how important the digital currencies and blockchain technology allow for looking beyond the traditional banking or the traditional financial infrastructure and finding solutions to scenarios where IRC works in areas or in countries that don't really have an established financial infrastructure. Examples I can give you is South Sudan, you know, rural areas in Syria, Libya, Yemen, places that we're working in or we're going into work in, and we don't really have a solution to provide financial assistance because nothing exists.
Yeah, Brett, it's interesting, and it's on one of your favorite term, the contextual engagement with the user.
Yep.
You know, you talk about it all the time, and take that, expand that about 1,000 times over with what Alan and the IRC are challenged with in this situation.
No, I completely understand. What about what about the issue of identity management and things like that, Alan? You know, are these people coming with, do they have identity documents, or is often that a problem as well?
Yeah, as Barry mentioned in the podcast she had with you, it really depends on the conflict or the situation that the refugees were in. In usual cases, they're basically leaving with whatever they have on the back, and on their hands or carrying on their backs. And in most cases, identification is not part of it. Additionally, passports are not a reality in most cases, and these are people who have not traveled internationally, so a passport is not usually easily available. So yeah. If they do have an ID, it's an ID that's not really recognized in a different country, right? One of the main problems we have from Syrian refugees going into Turkey was that the ID that they bring is not really useful. Additionally, in other countries that we work in, they don't have ID systems. So how do we go about first identifying them, through all the identifying them and then like mitigating all the risks associated to potentially, assisting people that could be trying to corrupt the system? And there's all these negative, concerns or risks that we have to mitigate. But additionally, it's difficult. It's difficult to really, one of the main problems that all these European countries are going to have with receiving these refugees and migrants is identifying who are refugees and who are migrants, because they receive different benefits.
Yeah, I know. Fair enough. And what are your plans when you first get on the ground in Greece?
We're actually in the process of defining what those plans are. So it's numerous. First of all, the logistics there is we're really working on everybody is, it's what I recently got told, all hands on deck. Everybody is, rushing around and trying to resolve this huge migrant crisis. So we're going to arrive there and we're going to have no resources available because they're already going to be taken up. Resources I'm talking about, like basic transportation, logistical staff, support, and all that. So my role, I'm going a week ahead of my partner. I'm going to be building the foundation for us to carry out this assessment.
So I'll teach you one Greek phrase. You say, tikanis kala?
Tikanis kala.
Yeah, it's hello, how are you?
Okay.
So you can start with that. All right, so that's great. If someone's interested in supporting IRC, how can we invest and support you guys?
So you can always visit the website called rescue.org, as you mentioned several times. Additionally, the IRC has a partnership with Google, as we're one of the four foundations that Google is. Yeah, so Google's matching donations. So whatever you donate, Google will match it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, we're pretty techie. We're really going out there. We're gonna be looking at digital currencies as a way to really cross borders, because it's pretty difficult to provide assistance when you're limited on in specifically countries. Yeah.
Okay, so Efaristo, that's thank you in Greece. Thanks for joining us on the show today. You can tell I'm a Melbourne boy, right? I grew up in the second largest Greek city by population in the world, Melbourne in Australia. So thanks for joining us, and we're grateful for the work you guys are doing at rescue.org and National Rescue Committee. And Sam, thanks for setting it up again.
Excellent. Thanks, Brett.
So
thanks,
guys, we're just about, we're getting close to Cybos. Stay tuned. October 11th, 15th will be at Cybos Inner Tribe. And keep in touch with Breaking Banks. Check out our previous episodes on breakingbanks.com. Thanks for joining the show today. We'll talk to you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.